morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 11th of April. Our guest this hour, the Executive Director of Answer Sex Ed Honestly at the Center for Applied Psychology at Rutgers University, says that sex education is not about teaching one topic to one age group, and that's It has to start at the earliest ages, build upon and reinforce the previous knowledge and skills learned, and evolve as students get older and become more likely to start having sex. Dramatic news yesterday concerning the rate of teen births in this country falling in 2010, and good news for the state of Wisconsin, where the rate was down 16% from 2007. The rate for teenage moms reaching its lowest point since record keeping began in 1940. So something's working. What is it? And how should we teach about sex? Elizabeth Schroeder is our guest, Executive Director of Answer Sex Ed Honestly at the Center for Applied Psychology at Rutgers. She's an educator, trainer, and author in the areas of sexuality education, curriculum development, and counseling. And she helps health professionals understand the best practices that are informed by the latest research in educational programming. She has trained thousands of young people, serving professionals, adolescents, and parents in this country. Co-founding editor of the American Journal of Sexuality Education, she is co-editor of the four-part book series, Sexuality Education, Past, Present, and Future. She has served as a co-author of Making Smart Choices, a curriculum for young people, Being Out, Staying Safe, an STD prevention curriculum for LGBTQ youth, and a number of other books. And we're delighted to have her with us this hour. We'll be welcoming phone calls as well. And I'd be particularly interested in hearing how either you received your sex education information in school, how your children or grandchildren are receiving information, and what you think is the best way to go here. Also, your thoughts about why teen birth rate is down significantly. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. And Elizabeth, thank you so much for being with us. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
This study that came out yesterday from the CDC, the report, is really pretty dramatic, isn't it? The lowest rate since the records were begun in 1940. Why?
Well, absolutely. It was so exciting to read this data, and at the same time that I was so elated, at the same time I was reading the article about the decision that happened in Wisconsin of the repeal of the Healthy Youth Act, and I was sitting here thinking, wow, Wisconsin, you had a 16% drop in the teen birth rate, as you said, and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention actually said that they think the decrease in the birth rate is because of increased use of contraception at first sex and use of dual methods of contraception. And what that means is using a barrier method like condoms as well as a hormonal method like the pill or the shot or the patch. That's what's contributed to the recent birth rate declines nationwide. Now, young people don't learn how to use those methods in abstinence only until marriage programs. So when you had this wonderful policy in Wisconsin that said you have to teach about abstinence as well as contraception and safer sex, why on earth did the legislature muck with that? You had this drop, and so now I'm very concerned for your state that now we're going to see those rates go up again.
They learn about contraception. They don't learn how to use contraception. Is that a correct understanding?
Well, in comprehensive sexuality education, they tend to learn about contraceptive methods and how they are used.
Yes.
In abstinence only until marriage programs, when contraception is contraceptive methods are taught about, they tend to focus on failure rates. So it's a very subtle way of really trying to talk young people out of using contraceptive methods. So it's really not providing the accurate information that young people need. They're really trying to convince them, you know what, you need to stay abstinent, and if you use these condoms or these other methods, they're not going to work anyway, so you should stay abstinent. It's a real way of misguiding and actually lying to young people that we just don't support doing.
Where do you think most young people get their information about sex?
What I hear and what we hear at sexetc.org, that's our teen-to-teen sexuality education program here at Answer, from young people is that they are getting most of their sexuality information from the media, in particular the Internet. And if you follow any of the information that comes from the Pew Internet Trust, they are saying right now that the number of young people between the ages of 12 and 17 who are looking for sexuality information by seeking out porn sites is astronomical. So we have a real challenge here. We have to provide medically accurate, age-appropriate information to young people, because if we don't, they're going to go online and they're going to get information from porn, and that's going to confuse them and misinform them. So it's really nervous-making to me that so many young people are getting their information from unreliable sources instead of coming to sexetc.org, instead of getting it in school, instead of getting it from parents and other trusted adults. It's a huge problem.
I agree. I think it's a very underreported problem, too. Porn sites are really prevalent, and you got to believe there are a lot of young people who are going to those sites. I know for a fact they're going to those sites.
Absolutely.
How you talk about sexuality education being something that begins very young and then just continues through a good portion of life, and maybe it should continue through all of our lives. When should we start sex education, and what do you see young people needing to learn when they're 5, when they're 7, when they're 10?
Well, first of all, we're actually educating young people about sexuality from the moment they're born. So the manner in which we interact with infants and toddlers, the way we touch them and hold them, the manner in which we behave with each other, the way we behave with people of the same or of a different gender, children are sponges, and they are watching us, and they're picking up that information from the earliest ages. And all of those lessons are part of sexuality education. I think people hear sexuality and they just focus on the sex part. So they think that sexuality education is about pregnancy prevention and STD prevention. And that's really important. That's an important part of it. But you have to start early, because that's all the foundational knowledge that they're getting. So, for example, when we're teaching kindergartners things like hands are not for hitting and hands on your own body, that's part of sexuality education, because when young children learn how to treat each other with respect as friends, it's paving the way for them to be respectful partners and spouses in the future. So we have to start early. The analogy I use sometimes is math. If you were teaching math in the 10th grade, you'd probably be teaching something like geometry or algebra. But just because that's what's age appropriate, we don't start teaching math in the 10th grade. We start in the earliest ages in kindergarten, first grade, to teach the foundational knowledge so that by the time we get to 10th grade, the student is ready to learn that stuff. So what we're teaching at the very elementary levels, basic, foundational, universal values of respect, boundaries about your own body and other people's bodies. And as everybody gets older, you add additional information with each year so that by the time they're in the high school and they need what people consider to be traditional sexuality education, pregnancy prevention, STD prevention, they're ready for it.
I know that a big part of your program is teen-to-teen sexuality education. Why is that particularly effective, teen-to-teen?
There is just tons and tons of research that shows that peer-to-peer, and that could be teen-to-teen or it could be adult-to-adult, but sort of whoever I identify my peer to be is very effective at educating about just about any topic. And especially when you have something like sexuality, which is such a huge topic for teenagers, but the reality is, even though teens really want to be able to talk with adults about this, sometimes they're just not comfortable. So when you have a teenager who is really trained to do this, and this is the big distinction we make, we don't just gather up some teens and say, okay, go talk to other teens about sexuality. The teens we work with go through very rigorous training on sexuality content, how to express this content in ways that are also age appropriate for their peers. And then they're the ones who write the Sex Etc. magazine. They're the ones who write the content for sexetc.org. And then other teens respond. We reach millions of teens every year because they're going online, but they're getting the information they need instead of getting it from porn or some other unreliable site.
Mm-hmm. Is there, Dr. Schroeder, a way for parents to become educated on this topic and to make their children feel more comfortable coming to them on sexuality matters?
Absolutely. There is so much support out there for parents. And I really feel like the abstinence only until marriage folks kind of have commandeered this dialogue and said, oh, parents just come to us, and they like to spread myths and misinformation and fear. But comprehensive sexuality education folks are really trying very hard to work with parents and other adult caregivers on how do you talk with your kids about sexuality. We think that parents are the first and most important sexuality educators of their children. But at the same time, that sentiment places a bit of an unfair burden on parents, doesn't it? Because when you become a parent, there's no automatic thing that shifts that suddenly makes you an expert in sexuality content. I know I have a doctorate in human sexuality. It took me 7 years to get it. And so when you become a parent, there's not something that all of a sudden happens that bestows all this knowledge of sexuality on you. We have to see this whole process of educating young people as a partnership. The schools and community-based organizations where there is expertise in content and skills and teaching and educational methods need to convey that to young people. The parents then at home have to take that content and reinforce it within the context of their family's values. But this adversarial thing of parents versus schools or parents versus educators has to stop. It's not serving young people. And in the end, we all want the same thing. We want young people to grow up healthy, happy, well-adjusted now, and that with information and skills that'll take them far into the future.
Well, the whole area has become rather controversial lately, and I'm not sure how this happened, but the whole controversy recently in the political realm concerning birth control, it was front and center, and maybe it'll fade a little bit now, but it's something that has been talked about politically, the whole health care and birth control issue, the abstinence versus comprehensive sex education. Why has this become so political, and how do we remove it, which may be a better thing, from the political realm?
These are great questions. What was that old show, the $64,000 pyramid or whatever it was? Wonderful questions. Because, to be honest, why is it in the news right now in particular? Because this is an election year. This is a hot-button topic. And the reason it's a hot-button topic is because there is a group of individuals who want it to be a hot-button topic. People have to understand that this is a very intentional campaign that is designed to spread myths, misinformation, and to rile up fear. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've been at a school board meeting and someone will stand up from a abstinence only until marriage program and say, these comprehensive people want to come in and teach your kindergartners how to have sex. Who would do that? No one would do that. It is so completely outside of the realm of reality and what any educator or any parent, I will speak as a parent as well, would do. But all you need is one person to stand up and to say something like that with conviction, and we have enough people who would say, really? That's what they want to do? So this is a very intentional campaign, and I think all the things that we've been seeing around women's health and reproductive health, sexuality education has been added into that now. So there's sort of a bit of guilt by association, even though I think there's no guilt involved there. But so now they've done stuff on women's health and reproductive health, and so now they're spreading out to sexuality education as well. And in the end, the only people who are suffering as a result of this are young people, because they're not getting the information and they're not getting the skills they need to be able to make healthy decisions.
Is there a way that you can say pretty much without doubt that the reason that teen births fell in this country in 2010 and Wisconsin's rate was down 16% since 2007 is because of comprehensive sex education?
Well, to say it without a doubt, there are very few things I think we can say without a doubt. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention are the ones who are saying that they think it is most likely that increased use of contraception at first sex and the use of dual methods of contraception are what led to the reduced birth rates, teen birth rates. And it's logical. It makes sense. And then if you take the logic to the next step, since they're not getting that information in abstinence only until marriage programs, it stands to reason they're getting the information from comprehensive sexuality education programs. And so that's how you connect the dots in that way. But what they're really reporting on, the CDC, is the data that they have. This is another big issue within sexuality education and all of these discussions and debates is we have research. We do have hard facts about the positive impact of comprehensive sexuality education programs. The challenge that we keep facing is we have a lot of abstinence-only until marriage people who will sort of look at this just as your governor did in Wisconsin and say, I disagree. So you have the factual information, and people are saying, yeah, I just don't believe you. So that's a real challenge because we have researchers and professionals who have done the interventions, who have studied the data, and they're telling us, the world, what the statistics are showing, and then people are sort of taking it from a belief standpoint. You can't say, it's like if someone has brown hair, you can't say, I don't believe you have brown hair. The fact is that it's there. So we're coming up against that a whole lot, and that's why legislatures are spending so much time and energy and money on debating these issues. It's really taking them around away from the main issue, which is how do we get age-appropriate, developmentally appropriate, life-enhancing and life-saving information to young people. They're not going to get it from abstinence-only until marriage programs.
Elizabeth Schroeder, our guest this hour, executive director for ANSWER, which is a national organization. It's based at Rutgers University, and it provides comprehensive sexuality education to young people and the adults who teach them. She has a doctorate in human sexuality education and has done work and written books on this area for a long time. We welcome phone calls. We are prompted to have this conversation today because of this study by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention finding that teen births are down across the nation, and in Wisconsin they are down substantially, which is good news. Is this partially because of comprehensive sex education? Do we run a risk of those rates going up if we use an abstinence-based program? Do we need a program that discusses abstinence pretty fully? Because obviously that's a way to prevent teen births. Or do we need full information that just includes abstinence? As you know, last week, the governor signed an abstinence-only sex education bill for schools. It promotes abstinence as the only reliable way to prevent pregnancy and sexually transmitted diseases. It mentions birth control, but does not teach teens how to use it. And how do you handle this whole issue in your family? Why is it that sexuality education, which is such a normal part of human life, is still such a difficult issue for parents and really for our society? It's filled with controversy. Should it be? Our lines are open for you. Our number is 800-486-8655. You can also send an email if you would like. That address is talk@wpr.org. Brett Jaspers is our new producer, along with Rhonda Fanning. He just moved here all the way from New York, so say hello to him and welcome him. Don't give him too hard a time. At least today, you can give him a hard time later on, but he will be answering your phone calls. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. To your phone calls, and we start with Michelle in Stevens Point. Hi, Michelle.
Good morning, Kathleen, and to your guests. Thank you so much for this program. I'm calling wearing two different hats. I've been trained in the Our Whole Lives program as a leader for students between junior high and high school age. And I'm part of a team from Central Wisconsin where, as part of our faith community, wanted us to go ahead and pursue this training so that we could bring the program to our young people and anybody else in the community interested. I'm also a parent of a child who went through the program when he was younger. I think he was ninth grade when he attended the program. And this is through Unitarian Universalist groups, including those in Wausau and Stevens Point. So the curriculum is comprehensive, and it sounds like I need to go to your guest speaker's website to see the wonderful things Rutgers has laid out. But I wanted to ask the guests a little more about how parents can get involved. In our community, I was able to access that program, and later I was able to be trained in it. But it is true that sometimes parents won't access this. It's an extra commitment. It's outside of school. And many people have told us that the curriculum is so wonderful that they wonder why it can't be in the schools. Well, clearly, after this ruling, it won't be in the schools. And I should note, too, that my son and others opted out of their local school sexuality curriculum just because they were able to fit more electives into their schedule and take this our whole lives on their own outside of school. And actually, educators here supported that because they knew it was a great program. And it stresses integrity and responsibility, integrity, respect. And wherever you're coming from, whether you are just exploring your sexuality as a young person or whether you're concerned because you may feel that you are on the GLBT population, there's something for everyone in that curriculum.
Elizabeth.
Well, first of all, Michelle, thank you for calling in and for your point. And I have to agree with you wholeheartedly that the Our Whole Lives program, in my opinion, I've been doing this work almost 20 years, is one of the strongest programs we have in the United States. For folks who aren't familiar with it, it is truly comprehensive because it begins in grade 12 and it is separated age appropriately. So you have grades K-2, you have grades 4-6. 7, 9, and 10 through 12. It's a phenomenal curriculum. And actually, back in the day when I was working in New York City and we were doing, this is before the New York City sex ed mandate came out, and I was doing sexuality education in the New York City public schools, I used many of the activities from Our Whole Lives. So I couldn't agree with you more. What I will say is one of the reasons you had asked why isn't Our Whole Lives in school systems, one of the challenges that the only challenge with Our Whole Lives is that it was not written for school with schools in mind. It was written to be delivered within the Unitarian Universalist or any other faith community to use. So as a result, it's really a logistical thing. So if you're in a school where you have a 45 or a 50-minute class period, it's much more challenging to fit in what are often two-hour chunks in the curriculum. You sort of have to pick and choose, and then you're using it that way in the school curriculum. Now, Our Whole Lives, you know, it's had a great impact on young people, but we don't know whether it would have the same impact if you start to dilute it down. So that's one of the issues that we've had in terms of using the curriculum. But I couldn't agree with you more that it is so strong. It really talks about sexuality in its most expansive topic. As I mentioned before, people tend to think this is just about pregnancy prevention, STD prevention, but Our Whole Lives, it's a great title because this is what we're talking about. We're sexual beings from the time we're born to the time we die, and even using that phrase is not going to resonate with some people because we have this adult viewpoint that sexual means sexual behaviors. But no, sexuality is about who we are and how we feel about our bodies and how we talk with other people and how we interact with other people. So it's a wonderful program. Now, how can parents get more involved? That's another great question because I really think parents should be involved. And the first thing parents should hear is every parent has the right to go into their school, to go to the school board, and find out what curriculum is being taught, and they should take a look at it. And if it's something, then they can do some research. They can always get in touch with us here at Answer, and there are also a lot of organizations in states and in the communities that can help parents understand, is this the curriculum that we want our children to be learning from? And they should be able to find that out. I also really encourage parents to go in, and I'm saying this as a parent now, I have my parent hat on, to come in with a real open attitude of, I'm coming in to partner with you. There really, again, is this adversarial relationship around sexuality education that shouldn't be there. So go in, hear what the educators have to say, hear what the curriculum specialist or the principal has to say, and then have a dialogue about it. But hopefully there's going to be a more comprehensive program and not the abstinence only until marriage programs, which research shows do not impact young people's sexual behaviors.
Thanks, Michelle, so much for your call. Michael in Linksville. Hi, Michael.
Yes, hi. Two questions. First one would be, is there any statistics that show with all the new advents for birth control and methods there are, for instance, the morning after pill, would that lower the number of, for instance, teen pregnancies? And are there statistics to show that or studies that have done on that? The second thing is the psychological ramifications for pornography amongst, teenage youth or just youth in general, and how they will serve their partner in the future, whether that be male or female, male, male, female, female. It doesn't matter to me. The important thing is the ramifications for the psychology that's rampantly available through, obviously, the digital revolution. For, children to behold, what is there studies that show what that will do psychologically? Those are the questions right there.
Good
great.
Questions.
Thanks, Michael.
Thanks.
And I agree, two really great questions. The first thing in terms of do we know about the new methods, all we know from the CDC at this point, and keep in mind the data were just released yesterday, is that the use of contraception and the sort of use of contraception in general, and in particular dual methods, so again a barrier method as well as a hormonal method, is what the CDC is saying may have really truly contributed to the reduction in birth rates. As far as I know, they didn't specify that it was this hormonal method over another one now that we have the patch, now that we have NuvaRing, those kinds of things. Generally speaking, with the hormonal methods, they're all extremely effective at reducing or preventing pregnancy if they're used perfectly. And that's a big important point. So you have to take a pill, one pill every day at the same time every day to get that perfect use rate. So it really has to do with how they're being used and the frequency of use versus new methods. As of now, Michael, that's all we sort of know at this point. But it would be an interesting thing to look at. Your second question in terms of porn, this is a tough question because we have always looked at the impact of any media on people's behaviors. We've done this with violence in the media. And with porn, the studies that I've read, they're kind of all over the place. And it kind of it depends on what people are seeing. Most of the research that I have seen is depending on the porn, like if it's sort of straightforward nudity sexual behaviors, that it doesn't have such a psychological traumatic impact on young people as much as it confuses and misinforms them, so, which is an equal concern because then you have young people coming away saying, oh, that's what I'm supposed to be doing, or that's the way I'm supposed to look, or only people in this type of relationship should be having sex. So people in same-sex relationships never have sex. It's only people who are man and woman or only of this race or ethnicity. So that's for sort of typical, straightforward sexual behaviors they're seeing. Now, we all know that there is some very hardcore porn and there are some behaviors that are sort of atypical sexual behaviors that really can frighten people when they look. It's the same thing if a child were watching a movie that were not for his or her age group. But we don't have research on what the long-term ramifications are. Kids get startled and scared by things all the time, but the good news is they are extremely resilient. So the hope is that if they see something like this, they have a trusted adult they can speak with, hopefully a parent or another adult caregiver, to sort of say, listen, I looked at this, I'm really confused, or it freaked me out, and then to be able to talk about it. But talking about it, and the parents and the adults have to take the lead to talk about it, even if it feels uncomfortable, that's the most important thing.
Elizabeth, you mentioned same-sex relationships.
Yes.
How do abstinence-only programs deal with same-sex relationships? How do comprehensive sex education programs deal with this? And is there a way to make sure that... Well, no. The second part of the question is, does comprehensive sex education make it easier for people to be more open about what their sexuality is? Has it made it easier for people who are gay to be able to express who they are and have people simply accept that?
Great questions. The abstinence only until marriage, I mean, when you consider that title right there and you consider that in most states in the United States, people in same-sex relationships can't get married, one would then get the sense that in abstinence only until marriage programs, they really don't talk about same-sex relationships because the expectation that they're putting out is that the only acceptable sort of relationship in which a person should have a sexual relationship is a marriage. So right there you have an exclusionary aspect of it. When you look at the abstinence only until marriage curricula, occasionally there will be a curriculum that gives a nod to this by being gender neutral. But when you read the actual content of the curriculum, it's all about male-female relationships. They really reinforce gender role stereotypes. They tend to be focused much more on girls than on boys. Girls are still set up to be the moral and sexual gatekeepers of relationships. Kind of boys will be boys. They're going to want to have sex. They're going to pressure you to have sex. So you girls have to be the ones to fend them off and fight them off. And it's as disrespectful to boys as it is unfair to girls. So we really don't see abstinence only until marriage curricula that are inclusive of LGBTQ young people, which is a huge problem about the programs. I also want to just pop in parenthetically here and hoping that everyone's hearing the language. There's a difference between an abstinence only until marriage program and a program that talks about and emphasizes abstinence while teaching other topics.
Yes.
No one in the comprehensive sexuality education world is against teaching abstinence. I myself have co-written an abstinence curriculum for use in middle school. The issue is how we teach about abstinence. What we tend to see in the abstinence only until marriage programs are just that, marriage promotion, really trying to push towards, you want to get married, here's what it means to get married, you want to wait to be married in order to have sex. It gives this sort of message of, like, sex is bad, sex is dirty, save it for someone you love. And so it really misinforms and confuses young people. But there's also this stereotype that, oh, the comprehensive sexuality education people don't value abstinence. We value it very, very much, but we also value young people, and we know that to teach young people about abstinence, you have to respect them, and you have to understand that they have great capacity for understanding how to make effective decisions. That's where we have to help them out.
Well, it was a mere few weeks ago we were talking about marriage rates and the report that came out on that and how nobody's getting married anymore. So that what's going on there? I don't know. It doesn't make a lot of sense. The studies don't jive, do they? Obviously, people are having sexual relations, but they're just not getting married. So how do you teach an abstinence program given that?
Well, and that's a great point, Kathleen, because that's the big issue. So even if you're, say you're teaching a middle schooler about abstinence until marriage, the middle schooler is maybe 12 years old. Even if folks get married, the average ages in the United States are mid-20s. So you're trying to teach them about something that they are waiting literally their entire lives, that they know their entire lives to do. Adolescents are very concrete thinkers. They're in the here and now. What they see is what they get. So when you try to sort of put this in the context of wait until you're married, it's too far off. It's too abstract of a concept, and so they can't get their heads around it. Instead, what we have to focus on is teaching them how to make an effective decision. If they choose to wait until whatever they determine is the time to wait, whether it's marriage or another long-term committed relationship or until a certain age, how do you keep to that decision? What are the skills you need? What are the supports you need? How do you get your parents to help you? How do you get your peers to help you? That's what we need to focus on. I'll give you an example. If you don't mind, I'd like to give you an example.
Sure.
Of what I heard. When I was before I came to work for Answer, I was a consultant, and I went and I interviewed some young people who had been through an abstinence-only-until-marriage program. And I asked a young woman who was about 16 years old, I said, so what did you take away from this program? What's a strong message you got? And she said, well, I've decided I'm going to be abstinent until I'm married and probably even after I'm married. And so I kind of smiled and I said, well, your future husband is probably going to want to talk with you about that, but can you tell me what made you feel, if this is really about waiting until you're married, what made you feel like you have to wait until even after you're married? And she said, we had a guest speaker who came in, a woman with AIDS, and she has AIDS because her husband cheated on her, got HIV, came back and gave it to her. So you see, you can't even trust your husband.
Oh.
And my heart broke when I spoke with her and when she told me that, because is that really the message that we want to give young people, that you can't trust anybody, that sex is a terrible, awful thing, you're going to get HIV, you're going to get AIDS, you're going to die? I mean, these are the messages that far too many abstinence-only-until-marriage programs have absolutely no problem communicating. It's like the ends justify the means. Michael before was asking about the psychological impact of porn. What about the psychological impact of trying to terrify young people out of being in a sexual relationship? A lot of the abstinence-only-until-marriage people have no problem with that. As long as they stay abstinent, we kind of don't care about how we may potentially be negatively affecting their psychological and emotional well-being.
So there's kind of an anti-sex message with it.
Absolutely.
Catherine in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi, good morning. Can you hear me okay?
Oh, yes. Go ahead.
Hello?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, we can hear you.
Thank you. And on the heels of that, I'm an educator, and I have kids ages 11 to 24. And I'll tell you, parents don't talk to their kids about sex. They just don't. I don't know what it is in our culture, but they don't. I know I was educated by Reader's Digest, you know, medical articles. That was how my parents didn't train us. But my son was 11 years old. He was sexually assaulted by a family friend. And I certainly believe that because we have been talking about body parts, his and women's, and the front of the Cosmo magazine, and all sorts of things in order to develop healthy attitude towards body and towards what's appropriate. You can't just bring up stranger danger when they're in K-5. You have to talk about sexuality on the level they understand. But in doing so, the night he was assaulted, he came to me, you know, when I had returned home and said what happened. And apparently that's very rare with incest victims, that they would report it. There wasn't any shame. He was terribly confused and eventually, you know, very traumatized. But the night it happened, he said, this is what happened. And he used all the correct words. Mm. And he said, I don't understand. Mm. And the counselors that worked with him through the county program, when we reported and the perpetrator was arrested, said, this is very rare that a child would come forth, would be so articulate about it. And I said, we've been talking about sex since she's going potty training. Mm-hmm. You know, sex on a level that starts with what you mentioned before about body image. So I feel like the fear and shame that already goes into that action and what happens to the victims is compounded by people that haven't had a healthy attitude instilled in them about their bodies or about sexuality.
Was he able to work through all of that? That's very traumatic, Catherine.
I'm sorry, say that again.
Was he able to work through this?
Yes. Yes, he's a very well-adjusted 25-year-old now. But his ability to come forth probably saved hundreds of kids from this victim.
Right. Elizabeth.
Well, first of all, Catherine, thank you so much for sharing that with us. I mean, that is a huge, huge thing, and there really is giving voice to someone who's been through this, who survived it, who's doing well and thriving now. But the fact that he was able to speak openly, it's really a credit to you and your family, the fact that he felt he could come to you. So a real kudos to you. And I couldn't agree with you more that parents have to talk with their kids about this stuff. I so get it. What I hear from parents a lot is, but my child's so innocent. Well, teaching them about their bodies and how it works, it's not about innocence or keeping innocence. They have to have the information that they need. And we have research that shows that when parents talk with their kids about sexuality, it actually helps kids to delay the onset of first intercourse. And when young people do become sexually active, it actually talking with them about sexuality, when parents are the ones who talk about it, it helps them to use safer sex methods and contraceptives more effectively. There's research showing the power of parent-child communication is there. So it just backs up what you're saying, Catherine. It's so, so important. But we are a culture. We use language like private parts. We don't refer to our noses or our elbows as private parts or public parts, you know.
You're right.
So we're giving these very, you know, very clear messages. The culture gives these messages to young people from earliest ages. There is something that you have on your body that you should be ashamed of. And so we have to, as parents, we have to, you know, sort of combat those messages so that we are building up their self-esteem. And we're saying that you are, you know, beautiful the way you are. You are wonderful the way you are. However, there are also boundaries. So you may be very proud of your genitals, but you still don't touch somebody else's. You still wear clothes when you're at school. You know, those kinds of things.
Well, you would have to be living in a heavily gated community with no access to music or television to be able to carry on with a level of innocence for much of your life. Sexuality, and not always in the best limelight, is all over our society. It is everywhere.
Yes. And, you know, there is a bit of an attitude from a lot of parents that I actually understand. Having worked with, just like you said, thousands of parents, I get it. This I want to be an ostrich and I want to put my head in the dirt,
right,
and ignore it and it'll go away. I don't want to see these things. But we can't. This is our job as parents. We have to engage in the unpleasant stuff that's going on around us, and we have to talk about the negative and also look for the positive. One of the things that I personally was unprepared for as a parent was how much time it would take me to sit and watch the television shows that my child watches. And I have to tell you, when it's the end of a long day and I'm sitting down and watching this, the last thing I want to do is watch a television show that was made for adolescents. But when I tell you that this is the prime time to talk with your child about sexuality, you look at what's there, you mute the show at commercials, and you turn to your child and say, these two people were just interacting. These two people just had their first kiss. What did you think? What do you think is the right age for two people to kiss like that? And you have all these opportunities. I think we have this stereotyping. It goes back to you have to have the talk about sexuality. So people think it's this eight-hour marathon with videos and hand puppets and all kinds of things that you're doing this big performance. But sexuality education has to start early, and it has to keep going. It's little drive-by nuggets. Another great place to talk with kids about sexuality, if you are in a community where you drive around in cars, the car is the best place to talk with your child about sexuality. First of all, you have a captive audience. They're not going anywhere. The second thing is you don't have the eye contact, and that can reduce some of the...
Oh, that's interesting.
Uh-huh. Absolutely. Particularly for adolescents where, you know, sometimes we bring up something to adolescents, and the minute we say, so I want to talk with you about something, already they're saying, ew, I know where you're going.
Right.
But you still talk about it. The other thing is that it's less intense for the parents. It's not just the kids who are feeling that it's intense. It's a huge, huge responsibility for parents. And so sometimes it can be helpful. I think you want to be careful and maybe not drive on the highway if this is particularly intense for you. But it's a great place to talk about sexuality.
And talking about television programs, I think Jeff in Milwaukee wants to discuss that. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, how you doing? Love the topic, by the way.
Good.
Here's my issue. I'm a new father, and a couple years back I took guardianship of a teenage girl with my wife. And like she had mentioned with the TV shows, the new television shows, I had an issue as soon as I started watching those shows with this teenage girl, you know, Secret Life of an Un-American Teenager, 16 and Pregnant, you know, things, those drama shows that don't really, I mean, she's been touting them pretty widely, and it kind of bothers me that teenagers are watching these shows these days. It just doesn't seem like they're getting the right information. It's all about the drama, and it's all about you know, the things teenagers thrive on, the drama. And it's just been a big issue to me. And my 7-month-old son, I wonder what it's going to be like when he becomes a teenager. You know, how is it going to be more difficult to talk to him about it because of these TV shows, or what's the deal with this?
Oh, Jeff, first of all, congratulations on being a new father, and congratulations on what you've been doing for your teenage daughter as well. And I hear you on all of this. Every one of these shows, even the most horrible, what you would see as the most horrible shows, there's teachable moments in there. And that's what we have to look for. I mean, the biggest challenge for us as parents is really tolerating sitting through the show. What's really, really important as parents is to come at these shows with by asking questions rather than telling them something. So we have to remember that adolescents and teens really value the media. It's a very, very important part of youth culture. So the minute we go in and we say, 16 and Pregnant, that's a stupid show. Why are you watching that? We've lost them. So instead, if we come in and say, wow, she's pregnant at 16 and her boyfriend just left, what do you think of that? Or in particular, because she's a bit older, to be able to say to her, what are your friends talking about? Sometimes getting it off of our kids and asking them to be experts on other young people their age can be really, really helpful. It's less intense for them. And so to say, so how do you talk about this? Do you know people who have experienced this? Come at it from the spirit of, I'm trying to learn here. They think that we're kind of dumb anyway, so they like to educate us.
So, they do, I know.
Absolutely. So use that to your advantage. And once you've done the asking and there's the dialogue, again, there's the opportunity for us as parents to then reinforce a value. So you might ask your daughter something, or when your son is older something, and they'll say something back to you that you really disagree with. So that's okay, because you want to know where they're coming from. But then it's also okay to say, like, huh, so you just said you thought it was okay for 15-year-olds to have sex. I actually think that you need to be older, and here's why. And then you have the dialogue so that you're a part of the dialogue, but you're not just being the authoritarian, this is the way it is, it's my way or the highway. The other thing I really suggest is there's the TV shows, and it's really easy to sort of demonize them. One of the most distressing things I do is I sit through the commercials with my child. And sometimes there is way more learning, particularly about gender and relationships, that can happen when you're watching all of the commercials that are on between the actual show. So I also invite people, sometimes you mute the commercials and talk about the show. Other times, don't mute the commercials and then mute the show and talk about the commercials.
Well, it's amazing, the commercials, too. How many commercials do we see for erectile dysfunction?
Sure.
It would seem as though a lot of parents are having conversations. What's that, Mom and Dad?
Sure.
You have to deal with sex education. It's all over the advertising world as well. We're going to welcome more phone calls. Here's how you reach us. And we have a couple lines open. They've been crowded. We're talking about... we're talking about a major report, that came from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, finding that teen births are down across the nation, and Wisconsin's births to teens has gone down some 16%, which is really remarkable. What's going on here? Is it because teens are using birth control? Is it because of the way that we're getting our sex education? And coupled with that, of course, other news that the governor in this state has signed an abstinence-only sex education bill for schools. There's been a great deal of controversy about whether or not those programs are effective and how we should teach sex education. We've been asking this question for years and years. Our guest is Elizabeth Schroeder, Executive Director for ANSWER, a national organization that's based at Rutgers. It provides comprehensive sexuality education to young people, and she's written a number of books on this issue. 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We also have some interesting emails we hope to get to. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to Katie in Milwaukee next. Hi, Katie.
Hi.
Hi.
I was just wondering if there's other states like Wisconsin that have this, like, abstinence-only education thing that we've just put in place, and if they've had, and if so, if when we looked at the statistics from the CDC, if they had lower drops or less success in reducing teen pregnancy, something that we might be able to figure out what might be going to look forward to, so to speak, in Wisconsin.
That's a great question, Katie, and thank you so much. So before I answer the question about what other states have, and I'm happy to share what I know about that, is one of the challenges we have with tracking the impact of sexuality education programs is the flip-flopping that we're seeing here, like what your state did. So you had the Healthy Youth Act that was signed into law, what was it, in 2010? So it was signed into law already. We saw a strong impact just of that. And then already a few years later, they're taking it away. So now suddenly we have to sort of start all over in terms of tracking the data and the statistics. So one challenge we have is when things constantly change. The second issue we have is because the educational system is very localized, what we will often see is there will be a state law or a state mandate, and then what happens in a specific school district or even in a specific individual classroom may or may not fulfill that mandate, and that's a little bit of a scary thing when you think about it. So you have 21 states and the District of Columbia that mandate some kind of sexuality education. You have 33 states and the District of Columbia that mandate HIV education. Here's a scary statistic. Only 13 of the states require that when it's provided, sexuality or HIV education must be medically accurate. That's a statistic that keeps me up at night.
Oh, my goodness.
Is that the most ridiculous thing you've heard? And so it is very problematic to sort of look at these policies at the state level and say, okay, so we have this language. Even in a state like New Jersey, we had the first comprehensive K-12 health education mandate that included a requirement to teach about what we call family life education or sexuality education. On paper, it is one of the best mandates in the United States. I think Oregon, the state of Oregon, has an extremely strong sex ed mandate as well. But when you go into the individual school districts, what you find is, you know, it could be fabulous in this one school, it could be fabulous in this one district, and then you can go into an area that's more conservative, and it's not actually being taught, or it's not being taught in a way that we know reflects best practices. So there's a blessing and a curse when you have localized control of educational programs. And because health education doesn't come under the No Child Left Untested laws, health is not, that's a little, way I refer to No Child Left Behind, is that because of all of this standardized testing. Health is not a tested topic. So to not teach about sexuality, there tends not to be a repercussion in the school system. So the system is very flawed in that way. That's the reason why we have to get to the education professionals, and this is why ANSWER reaches over 6,000 professionals nationwide every year, to give them the professional development they need to be able to address sexuality. What we also have to keep in mind is, aside from the classes that teach sexuality education, there are also so many opportunities in a school environment for young people to ask questions. So for this reason, we don't just want to reach the health education teachers, the ones who are teaching in the classroom, because we know that young people go to the adults with whom they feel most comfortable. They don't just go to the person who's teaching it. A lot of times the teacher who's teaching about sexuality is the PE teacher, and a young person might not feel comfortable with that teacher, or the health teacher. They don't feel comfortable. They have a good relationship with the French teacher or the math teacher. So those teachers need to get some basic training as well, just to know how to respond to questions. And that's something that we really, really try to help schools and districts with.
I want to make sure we're running out of time, that we have a website people can go to. Which one do you want to use, or two?
Well, it's two, and thank you, Kathleen.
Sure.
If you are a professional or a parent and you need support and help, we are here for you. If you go to answer.rutgers.edu, that is our organizational website. If you are a teenager or you have a teenager in your life, please go to or send them to sexetc.org, and they will get age and developmentally appropriate information from other teens about sexuality. It's really a great resource for them.
That's sexetc.org.
Exactly.
Great resource. Thank you so much for being with us, Elizabeth. It was a good hour. Thank you.
Well, thank you for having me.
Elizabeth Schroeder, Executive Director for ANSWER, the national organization. It's based at Rutgers, providing and promoting comprehensive sexuality education to young people and also to the adults who teach them. We'll put up those, in case you missed it because you didn't have a pen with you, we'll put up those website suggestions on our Facebook page, too, which is the Kathleen Dent Show. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Brett Jaspers for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We'll have news coming up from National Public Radio and return with more Wednesday conversation.